The Romans retreated, and at that point, Titus decided that instead of attempting an assault within the city, he should starve it. So he built his own siege wall around Jerusalem. Josephus informs us that due to a very rainy preceding winter, Jerusalem had plenty of water. But because the rival groups had already burnt each other's food supplies, the siege was terribly effective. Welcome to Jerusalem 365, episode 91. The final battle begins. I'm Meir Soloveitchik. Let us speak of Jerusalem's third wall. This, according to Josephus, was a wall extending around Second Temple Jerusalem's northern suburb called Bezeta or Bethesda. The wall was begun by Agrippa I, created in so strong a manner that it inspired the suspicion of Rome, bringing the building to an end. The third wall was then completed in 66 CE by the Jews of the Great Revolt. In the early 20th century, it was taken for granted that the remnants of a wall discovered by the archaeologist Edward Robinson was this third wall. Thus it was that by 1926, the JTA reported that, quote, the excavations of the Agrippa Wall, commonly known as the Third Wall, around Jerusalem, being carried on by the Jewish Archaeological Society under the auspices of the Hebrew University, are nearly completed. And the article adds, the exact line of the third wall now seems to be fixed, end quote. Yet later, the identity of this wall, also known as the Sukenik Meir Wall, was challenged by the archaeologist Kathleen Kenyon and her team. Thus Herschel Shanks writes, quote, this part of the report was written by Emmett W. Hamrick, area supervisor of the three trenches Kenyon excavated perpendicular to the Sukenik Meir Wall. In what Hamrick calls the foundation deposit of the wall, the material thrown up against the base of the wall when it was built, the excavators found considerable pottery that can be securely dated. None of it dates later than 70 AD, so the wall must have been built earlier. But a number of coins were also found in this foundation deposit. Two so-called procurator coins are of special interest. The first dates from the 14th year of the reign of Emperor Claudius, 54 AD. The second dates from the 5th year of Nero's reign, 58 AD. According to Hamrick, the locus where the Claudius coin was found was homogeneous with the rest of the foundation deposit. If the Sukenik Meir Wall may be dated by these coins, then that wall cannot be the third wall built by Agrippa I between 41 and 44 AD. You can't have coins minted in the 50s sealed in the foundation deposit of a wall built in the 40s. The wall must have been built after 58 AD, end quote. It is therefore assumed by some that this is not the third wall after all. Now, of course, to all this, one might easily ask, who cares? Why should it matter whether a wall that was created not long before Jerusalem fell has been identified today? This wall was not part of David's city, nor was it biblical or Hasmonean in any way. Why is it so essential to determine its location? Why has there been so much discussion about it? The answer, as Shanks explains, was originally linked to a debate between Christians. Edward Robinson, based on the location of this wall, was attempting to make the case that what was and is called the Church of the Holy Sepulchre was mislocated because Jesus, in his view, had been buried elsewhere. Today, Shanks notes, it is assumed that the location of the third wall is unrelated to this issue. But there is, I think, a reason why Jews ought to be interested in the location of the third wall. For it was there, in the midst of the final battle for Jerusalem, that Jews actually joined as one against the enemy, in a defense that proved initially successful, and which inspires us to wistfully wish that this unity had been a constancy, and to ponder what might have been. Like so many other parts of his record, Josephus' description of the final battle for Jerusalem is lengthy and elaborate, and so for today's discussion, I'm enormously grateful to Gershon Bar Kochva and Aaron Horovitz's book, A Temple in Flames, for its incredibly succinct and organized summary of the assault, as well as its accompanying images. As we've seen, the siege and assault by Titus began to be put in motion during the Pesach, or Passover season, after countless Jews had entered the city for the holiday. The city itself was, on Passover, suffused in battles between several rival rebel groups, leaving two at war with each other within the city. One led by Yochanan of Gush Chalav, a.k.a. John of Giskilla, and the other by Shimon Bar Giora. Titus, then, sent Josephus to the Jews defending Jerusalem to ask for their surrender, and, upon receiving a refusal, began to plan his assault by circling the city walls looking for weak points. Titus chose to attack at the southwestern end of the third wall, near what is known as the Hippicus Tower. He therefore ordered his soldiers to prepare embankments of earth around that wall, elevated areas on which enormous siege towers 50 cubits high could be rolled. The fifth, The 12th and the 15th Roman legions each created their own embankment, with archers and javelin throwers in between to provide cover. With the siege towers established, archers would perch atop it to assault those standing on the ramparts and to protect what would emerge from within the siege tower itself, a massive battering ram that would attack the wall as the Romans sought to create a breach. It is in describing the Roman assault on the third wall that Josephus tells us of an extraordinary moment within the city. Extraordinary because it ought not to have been. The rival factions of Jerusalem joining together to defend against this Roman attack. Describing the rebel response to the siege towers, Josephus writes, quote, "The parties, consigning their hatred and private quarrels to oblivion, thus became one body, and lining the ramparts, they hurled from them showers of firebrands at the machines and kept those who were impelling the battering engines under incessant fire. The more venturesome, dashing out in bands, tore up the hurdles protecting the machines, and, falling upon the gunners, seldom through skill but generally through intrepidity, got the better of them." End quote. In this moment of unity, an amazing assault was waged on the Roman embankments, with one rebel force slipping out a gate and setting fire to the siege towers. We suddenly see, for one moment, Jewish Jerusalem working together. By the 7th of Iyar, almost 1 month after Passover, one Roman siege tower, wielding a massive battering ram known as Nikon, or the Victor, succeeded in breaching the third wall. The Jews slipped behind the second wall and waited for the Romans to break through and enter the city. When that occurred, the Jews had the advantage of street-to-street combat, wherein the Roman legions were not able to engage in their usual maneuvers. Thus Josephus tells us, quote, "Some confronted them in the streets, some assailed them from the houses, while others, rushing outside the wall by the upper gates, caused such commotion among the sentries on the ramparts that they leapt down from the towers and made off to their camp. There were cries from those within, surrounded by a ring of enemies, and from those without, alarmed by their intercepted comrades." End quote. We get a sense, reading about the final assault, how at their best the two rebel groups coordinated, repelled the enormous army of invaders. And we wonder, as historians have, how much more effective a united, militarily strategic Jewish force in Jerusalem might have been. But at this point, it was too little too late. The Romans retreated, and at that point, Titus decided that instead of attempting an assault within the city, he should starve it. So he built his own siege wall around Jerusalem. Fascinatingly and painfully, Josephus informs us that due to a very rainy preceding winter, Jerusalem had plenty of water. But because the rival groups had already burnt each other's food supplies, the siege was terribly effective. Josephus hauntingly paints the picture. Quote, "For the Jews, along with all egress, every hope of escape was now cut off. And the famine, enlarging its maw, devoured the people by households and families. The roofs were thronged with women and babes completely exhausted. The alleys with the corpses of the aged. Children and youths with swollen figures roamed like phantoms through the marketplaces and collapsed wherever their doom overtaken." End quote. Thus it was that 49 days after Passover, when the holiday of Shavuot arrived, it went, compared to the usual holiday celebration, virtually unmarked in the temple. This is terribly ironic, considering that the suffering in Jerusalem was linked to the civil war among Jews within the city, and that the holiday of Shavuot, as rabbinic tradition informs us, commemorates the giving of the Torah at Sinai to Israel. In discussing Shavuot, I often tell the tale of two synchronized swimmers named Carolyn Waldo and Michelle Cameron, who faced off in the Olympics against identical twins known as the Josephson sisters. The Wall Street Journal tells us that, quote, "Waldo and Cameron were anything but twins. They have different heights, ages, hair colors, and personalities, and hail from different ends of the country. To compete against the Josephsons, Waldo and Cameron decided to try to be more twin-like. They began warming up at the same pace. When they weren't swimming, they would look at each other and align movements, sometimes with music playing. They played thinking games to see if they could tell which part of the routine the other one was visualizing. Minutes before competing, they synchronized heart rates." End quote. Waldo and Cameron won the gold in 1988, and eerily, the journal adds, similar events occurred to them at various points throughout their lives. We are told that Waldo reflected that, "In a strange way, we have been on the same page since we left swimming," and that a coach described the bond between the synchronized swimmers as akin to a wireless connection. As a metaphor for Shavuot, it is, I think, profound. For at Sinai, the Talmudic sages say, the Israelites assembled as one, in Hebrew, ki ish echad belev echad, as one person with one synchronized heart. To mark Shavuot, is to remember the day that the members of the chosen people stood circling Sinai, creating a metaphysical bond that would never be lifted. And if the starvation during the festival of Shavuot prevented the holiday from truly being celebrated, there is a terrible poetic justice, for the famine was itself due to the refusal of Jewish Jerusalem to synchronize their hearts with one another, to join together, to allow their spiritual pulses to beat as one. What this means, as we ponder this point in the war with 2 months left to the final destruction, we realize that the stand by the Jews of Jerusalem at the Third Wall was an important moment in Jewish history. For it was there that the Jews within Jerusalem stopped for a moment being enemies of one another and turned to defend Jerusalem from the real enemy. And we may well know today where that occurred, for despite the controversy over where the Third Wall actually stood, the Israel Antiquities Authority recently announced in an article that we have sent you that it believes it has finally found the true historical specimen. Quote, "Impressive and fascinating evidence of the battlefield and the breaching of the Third Wall that surrounded Jerusalem at the end of the Second Temple period was exposed in recent months in the Russian compound in the city center. The finds were discovered in an archaeological excavation the Israel Antiquities Authority conducted in the location where the new campus of the Bezalel Academy of Arts and Design is slated to be constructed. During the course of the excavation, archaeologists discovered the remains of a tower jutting from the city wall. Opposite the tower's western facade were scores of ballista and sling stones that the Romans had fired from catapults towards the Jewish guards defending the wall, who were stationed at the top of the tower. According to Dr. Rina Avner and Kfir Arbib, excavation directors on behalf of the Israel Antiquities Authority, this is a fascinating testimony of the intensive bombardment by the Roman army led by Titus on their way to conquering the city and destroying the Second Temple. The bombardment was intended to attack the sentries guarding the wall and provide cover for the Roman forces so they could approach the wall with battering rams and thereby breach the city's defenses." End quote. If this turns out to be what it seems to be, then we can today stand at the actual site of the Third Wall, the site where the Roman assault began. And that means that we can stand at the site where, as Josephus reflects, the defenders finally put their enmity aside. And there, surrounded by the remnants of ballistae that were once launched at Jerusalem's defenders, we, as Jews, can resolve not to allow enmity to divide the Jewish people when it comes to the defense of Jerusalem. And we can pray that the Jewish people merit the security of Jerusalem for all time to come. This is Meir Soloveitchik, looking forward to learning together tomorrow. Signing off.